The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Swedish-British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of five books, Pelle Nyroff-Taylor, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nyroff-Taylor Show for our second hour of this TNT News Talk. Well, spring has finally arrived in Sweden, the Swedish flag behind me, where the studio is located. But I sometimes think on these spring afternoons back to my time when I was living in Brussels, where beautiful young women working as stagiaires or as staffers at the European Parliament would sit in the cafes and flirt and drink cafe latte and glass of wine or whatever, and strike deals and talk about their MEPs, members of European Parliament. All very pleasant, this European quarter in Brussels with their plentiful cafes and restaurants and people dining out on the European taxpayers' dime. And if you're part of that golden crowd, it's very pleasant and there's nothing wrong in the world. They say that politics is Hollywood for ugly people, but these were not ugly people. And if you do a beauty contest between staffers in the capital and the staffers of the European institutions in Brussels, I dare say that this is one competition the Europeans would win anyway. This beautiful environment is now changed. I judging by video footage, the weather's dull, and there are hundreds of European tractors from all over the European Union spewing manure all over the European buildings. And I have to say, there's certainly kind of Schadenfreude. Part of me shares that feeling because the European Eurocrats are legislating things that are completely out of touch with what the farmers and common people do. But the farmers are more feisty than most of us, so they've gone down to Brussels, their tractors, to make their feelings known. And the problem is many farmers find it difficult to make a living because of micromanagement by the Eurocrats on terms of achieving carbon zero targets. And of course, a lot of people think that making a living as a farmer is more important than abstract zero targets. And they're also incredibly, if you read some of the articles on farming and the farmers' gripes, they have to fill in long forms to grow food. And, you know, it all seems designed by people who've spent too much time sitting in those cafes and not enough time with their muddy boots in the soil. Anyway, the European Union, fearing a populist backlash in the elections in May, as we know, in June, sorry, have kind of reversed their position on some of the stricter rule requirements. So that's a good thing, under siege from these farmers. And if only the world's European populations would gather up in Brussels to protest other things, like, let's say, the Ukrainian war or the gas prices, and maybe illegal immigration or something like that. But it's not, I mean, the farmers are not just heroes, and there is another story, and we owe it to the Polish political contingent in the European Parliament to bring this to my attention. And that is, of course, that the Ukrainians were hoping to sell their food to Europe. But Ukraine doesn't have any industry left, and it's known as the breadbasket of Russia, or used to be. I mean, the black earth there is the most fertile soil in the world. And they export huge amounts of grain, but not to Europe, because Europe won't let in this cheap, competitive grain. And not least Polish farmers are blocking the Ukrainian border. So on the one hand, we're sending them weapons and urging them to fight for European values and whatnot. On the other hand, we're not letting in the only thing they could possibly sell to us, because European farmers do not want to share such subsidies that they do get, or be outcompeted for European grain. And this was actually, the Ukrainian grain issues was actually an issue in the EU association agreement back in 2013, when they said, you're part of Europe, we're going to welcome into you the European family and away from those horrible Russians. And the Russians said, well, are the Ukrainians going to be allowed to sell their grain? And they said, no. So Putin pointed that out, and he said, well, you can buy some cheap oil and gas from us, continue to do that, and we'll continue to have our free trade agreement, because all the Europeans offer is promises and dreams of being Western, but they won't actually buy your stuff. And the Ukrainian leader at the time, Yanukovych, actually went along with this logic, but the Western-sponsored protesters in the Maidan said, no, we want to be part of Europe. And then you had this coup. So one of the issues was, you know, the Ukrainians couldn't sell their grain to Europe because we didn't want it. We were big on words, but not big on free trade causes. And the Poles do have one point, is that we perhaps inside our cozy little European Union, we should be self-sufficient in food, at least, because that's what you want in cases of crises, because the neoliberal aspects of the European Union, they do want to reduce subsidies for farmers at the same time as they're making it difficult to make a living with all these extra bureaucratic regulations. And the solution is to buy cheap farming products from South America and from Ukraine and maybe North Africa, which is good for these countries concerned. But if there's a crisis, we can't solve it because, you know, shipping routes will be interdicted and so on. And our experience of World Wars One and Two is that you have to be self-sufficient in food. Anyway, we'll try and have a Polish MEP on to try and defend Polish farmers' actions. But it shows you that farming is not a simple issue. But anyway, these farmers have struck a necessary blow in terms of direct democracy and put the rest of us to shame sitting here in front of our laptops. Anyway, we're going into a quick break, and then we've got Basil Valentine with today's second helping of latest news. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk.
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine, our political editor, with us. Hi, Basil.
Good afternoon, Pelle. Yeah, I just want to pick up very quickly on the farming business. Of course, when Britain left the European Union, taking back control of things like agricultural policy was supposed to be one of the great victories. But it seems here in the UK, the Conservative government's post-Brexit environmental land management schemes, which are being rolled out across England, including the so-called Sustainable Farming Incentive, the SFI, means that we may be in for food shortages here in the UK, or at least increased prices. This has irritated, amongst others, Jacob Rees-Mogg, an MP for North East Somerset and a rural constituency, who said the green ideology seeks to make us not only cold and poor, but also hungry. It makes no economic or social sense and needs to stop. One farmer, Stephen Holt, who farms 670 acres in Northamptonshire, said government subsidies are incentivizing farmers to reduce domestic food production in favor of wildlife. He told the Times newspaper that he has signed up for the Sustainable Farming Incentive, which means replacing a break crop of oilseed rape and beans between wheat harvests with a legume cover crop to help pollinators and soil health. However, that crop won't be harvested for food. So, you know, there you go.
Well, they say that the bees are dying out because we don't have enough pollinators or pollinating crops. The thing is about policies, that everything has knock-on effects on everything else, doesn't it? So there could be an argument for what he's saying, but of course, more bees might mean less humans. I mean, just really simplify what you just said. what he's doing is creating crops that would be favorable to bees. I mean, we've got this global bee shortage, apparently, and without bees, humankind would die out because they pollinate all our plants.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Rees-Mogg is being a bit alarmist, to be honest. You know, you could grow all the food we need in England for a year in a relatively small area. You know, we're a million miles away from sort of actual food shortages in this country. I think it's not like Haiti or Gaza. There are dreadful food shortages. Brings me on to my second point about the UN resolution, which is, of course, binding. Not that you would know that if you listen to either the US ambassador to the Security Council or indeed the spokesman John Kirby. And this draws the distinction between international law and what the United States likes to call its rules-based order, which basically means that it makes up the rules as it goes along and orders everyone else to follow them. This is particularly relevant to the ceasefire resolution with respect to Gaza, which is binding. But the United States has effectively given Israel a get-out clause saying it isn't binding. As a result, it's carrying no weight at all. And just in the last 24 hours, another 76 Palestinians have been murdered by Israeli strikes on Rafah. So, I mean, this ceasefire was only supposed to last for 2 weeks. You know, the Russians wanted it to be permanent. That word was taken out by the Americans, but it isn't even that, I'm afraid to say. With or without the American cover, the Israelis never had any intention of abiding by it.
So this is incredibly good news. You know, I mean, I said, I think there's some people on the on these shows who say, well, UN means world government and we're going to be men in grey and follow, eat the same food. I mean, we're already doing that, globalism with globalism. But I mean, I think that the UN can be a useful forum for international diplomacy, you know, and it's great if people spend all their time worrying about one line here in the text. If nations' collective energies are spent on that rather than fighting each other, I think that's a good thing. And I've enjoyed reading good diplomatic books about the UN, about the battles that were going on in the UN's heyday. And it's quite exciting, diplomatic history. But what the Americans did, we were all hopeful that, oh, wow, they've distanced themselves from the Israelis and they're going to go along with international law because there's a binding Security Council agreement, which the Americans didn't refuse to veto. The Americans recused themselves. So we've now got a binding UN. The Americans and the Russians are kind of collaborating a little bit, the Americans by at least abstaining and the Russians by pushing it. And it turns out the Americans have no intention of doing anything about it at all because they say, oh, UN Security Council resolutions are not binding. That's really bad. And as you say, they say they're saying we follow the rules-based national order, international order. But what this is, isn't this the rules-based international order? UN Security Council resolutions. That's gold in the diplomatic currency. And the Americans are just torpedoing it to save their Israeli friends.
Although, even though the White House spokespeople have reiterated that there's been no change in American policy, that hasn't stopped this mere, you know, ruffling of Israeli feathers from infuriating the regime in Tel Aviv. Netanyahu cancelled a delegation trip to Washington in retaliation, saying, I thought the US decision in the Security Council was a very, very bad move. It's a really abysmal situation, worst of all for the people on the ground in Gaza, for whom there seems to be no end to the torment in sight.
And there was another good news story, sort of, was that Trump, whose son-in-law, famously, Jared Kushner, is Jewish and made that comment about the Gaza Strip and real estate developments there or something. Trump said, well, Israel is going too far. So maybe the MAGA movement is kind of lining up a little bit. Is that another will-o-wisp?
Trump, of course, famously, when he was running originally back in 2016, said that he would be even-handed in his negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And that comment brought howls of anguish, of course, from the Zionist side, you know, because American presidents are not supposed to be even-handed. They're supposed to be on Israel's side. And of course, when he became president, he was lauded for moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and they named some of the illegal settlements in the Golan Heights after him, if you remember, different type of Trump towers. But Trump isn't as easily controlled by the Zionist lobby in Washington as some others, including Biden himself. So, yes, I mean, he was really echoing what Chuck Schumer said, which is that, you know, Israel is well on the way to being a global pariah as a result of its actions in Gaza. And this will only have very bad long-term consequences for Israel.
Who was the originator of that?
Trump was echoing Chuck Schumer, who originally made those remarks.
I mean, it, it,
It's perfectly true. And what the UN ceasefire resolution shows, the fact that it was brought by these 10 elected members of the Security Council, temporary members, headed by Mozambique, is this gulf in world opinion between the global south on the one hand and the remnants of the American empire on the other. There's a shift in public opinion occurring, which isn't going to be reversed.
But Basil, quickly, what's the next step in this UN circus then? Are the Russians and the Chinese and others, the Brits, saying, well, hang on, America, these are binding things. Are you going to destroy the entire basis for the UN, or what are you doing?
Exactly. Well, it's supposed to lead to countries then being able to sanction any country that defies a binding UN Security Council resolution. So what it means is that, for example, the Colombian president has said that countries should start breaking off diplomatic relations with Israel. Four European countries have said that they are independently, this is Spain, Belgium, Ireland, and Luxembourg, I think, are going to unilaterally start taking steps towards recognizing a Palestinian state. And of course, they've been threatened with retaliation by Israel.
Okay, we've got to break there for the next guest. So just to summarize, I think that although America's ignoring UN regulations and Security Council resolutions, it might mean the rest of the world is taking them seriously and push this compulsory regulation passed against Israel seriously. And we will see how it develops. And I'm sure we'll keep up to date with it. Thanks a lot, Basil. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
This is our political editor, Basil Valentine, on today's News Talk TNT with Pelle Neroth-Taylor. Back after a break.
TNT's James Freeman.
Now that I'm sitting on the other side of the fence, I see the budget in a very different light. I find the discussions and leaks in the press in the weeks running up to the budget totally patronising. You know, will he, won't he, give us some tax cuts? When the reality is that nothing in the budget will make any material difference to anyone, pretty much. That's usually the story. It is a game of musical chairs where the government giveth with one hand and taketh with the other, and we're all reminded about how little money that we've got left in our pockets.
James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Oh, yes.
Then I'll begin.
Even when you're just sitting around, we're rocking the talk.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show for the second hour of our afternoon show. We're going to head off to South Africa again. I've made friends there, and I've been and made a documentary film. And I talked to an organization called AfriForum, whose representatives have been on this show. And their concerns, their opponents call them far right and preppers and violent, you know, have bad words for them. But they're very popular in South Africa itself with the Afrikaner-speaking community, which is about half the white population, or slightly more than half, I think, of about 5 million people. And Afrikaner is a language related to Dutch, and they are the original settlers. They've been there since 1652 or whatever, and they don't feel they have anywhere else to go but stay in Africa. They felt they built up the country by and large, and they do not, and they worry about an attrition of their identity from both the global Anglophone culture and from Black African culture. And some of them talk to me about, in a quite intellectual way, actually, citing people like Tolstoy, who, after writing War and Peace, which is, you know, this famous magnum opus, was a kind of philosopher of simplicity and primitivism. I mean, he retired to farm with his wife, and, you know, so he's been cited as a kind of peace campaigner and agriculturalist and sort of believes in this self-sufficiency. And they explain, well, that's what we want for AfriForum. We want the Africana movement. We're divided in this vast continent and across South Africa, and we're going to try and unite ourselves through the internet into this virtual community, which is self-sufficient in terms of farming and which has the old Africana ways. They've got long beards and so on. And they gave quite a, and they said, we're not anti-black or anything. We just want to have our ways. We live in a, with 2 or 3 million people in a planet of 8 billion people on a continent of 1.5 billion. Good. So believe us. And I took that on board. I want to give their case because anything that the mainstream media are opposed to, I kind of take up as a case worth having. Another movement was the Sidelanders. I never met Simon Roche, but I've heard of him back then. And I've heard of him ever since. I followed some of his stuff, but we are privileged to invite him onto this show. The Sidelanders, if I pronounce that right, are the world's largest independent civil defense organization. They were constituted under the additions to the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which allow for identifiable ethnic groups, that is the Afrikaners in this case, to prepare to defend themselves in lawful ways in the event of a perceived threat to themselves as an ethnic group. So Simon is here to discuss claims about the Sidelanders, what they're about, and generally more about the implosion of the West, culture wars, and prepping. Welcome to the show, Simon. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having Sidelanders on your show.
Because we've had a couple of AfriForum people on this show, and how do you differ from AfriForum? Are you just a kind of a rival grouping, or do you have a different mission?
We have a very different mission. We believe that a civil conflict is inevitable in South Africa, and so we prepare for that. That's our sole mandate, if you like, whereas AfriForum has a much broader agenda. It is a civil society initiative. It's involved in many various and different things. All we do is prepare for what we believe to be an inevitable civil war.
Okay, Simon. So, I mean, I was there, and the crime rates are staggering, and you dare not go out, apart from between cars, shopping centers, and hotels. And although I love the people, that's very alarming. But from what, when you say things with such certainty that it's going to be a civil war, on what do you base that certainty?
Well, we partly base it on a series of prophecies given about 100 years ago that turned out to be, you know, to the extent that the 700 odd have been fulfilled, astonishingly accurate. And there are some that have not been fulfilled yet. We also base it on just good old-fashioned common sense. You know, I used to work one desk away from the head of South Africa's oldest historically traceable tribe. So a man who in traditional African society in South Africa is very, very highly regarded. And when Julius Malema famously said that he's not calling for the slaughter of all whites yet, this guy, he was then the prince regent, he's now the king of that tribe, said to me, you know, in African idiom, that means that he is going to call for the slaughter of all whites. He was giving me an academic understanding. He said, a white woman in European idiom could say to her husband, I want to kill you. He said, we don't have that in our idioms. Mm. That means that she has a genuine and actual desire to kill. He said, so when we blacks hear Julius Malema say that, it means only one thing to us. And of course, we see the decline of the country slipping into very dangerous
Simon, before you continue, can I just interrupt to clarification? Mm. So was this Julius Malema who told you, or Julius Malema's a colleague or someone who's close to him?
No, Julius Malema made that utterance outside a court in the town of Newcastle in the province of KwaZulu-Natal in 2016. I believe it was Thursday, the 6th of November.
And what you're saying is that when someone like that says it, like in black, South African black culture, when you say something, it has to be interpreted literally.
Yes.
Yeah. And And Julius Malema, just for a global audience, who is this guy? I know he's the head of a party. He's a kind of radical land distribution politician who's got quite a lot of votes. So, but you, yes, fill us in a little bit about who he is.
Well, he was part of the African National Congress, which is a communist party. The ANC is not a standalone entity. Many foreigners don't know that. It's composed of three legs, one of which is the South African Communist Party. And he felt that the African National Congress wasn't radical enough. So he established in 2013 his own party called the Economic Freedom Fighters, which is genuinely Marxist. And he's called for radical land reform and all land to be given back to blacks and so on and so forth. And he, last year, during the 10th anniversary celebrations of the party's existence, he famously led the singing of 100,000 people. I know the stadium very well from my former profession. It was 100,000 people singing, "Kill the farmer, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, kill the Boer." So that's who he is, a nasty piece of work.
Simon, we're going to carry on talking about the other indications that you're heading towards civil war after a very quick news break. And we'll talk about maybe your ANC past, which is absolutely fascinating, really interesting things. Anyway, thanks, Simon. This is the TNT, today's news talk on TNT. And we'll be back in a few minutes after a break.
Attention!
Special bulletin, special bulletin.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Former U.S. President Donald Trump expressed concern that Israel is losing a lot of support due to its actions in Gaza and advised the country to conclude its military operations swiftly to prevent further damage to its reputation. France is facing significant challenges in delivering on President Emmanuel Macron's promise to supply 3 billion euros in military aid to Ukraine amid plans for substantial spending cuts to address a budget deficit of 145.5 billion euros.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We've got Simon Roche, who's a spokesman for the Sidelanders of South Africa, an independent civil defense organization. And we're talking about what he says is the inevitable civil war that's going to come to this racially mixed country where whites are less than 10% of the population. So, Simon, so this Julius Malema guy, I've seen his speeches, sort of very fiery and so on. And, of course, he wants compulsory expropriation of land, perhaps without compensation, I think. And we know there's been expropriation of farms, but they've been compensated. The white farmers, they produce nearly all the food in South Africa. Very few of these farms have been taken over by blacks are productive, but at least people have been paid for it, and then they can go and settle in England or Australia. But he's calling for compulsory expropriation of white land and white residences, I guess, which are owned, because whites still own. If you go to the nice areas of Johannesburg or Pretoria, you know, you have these lovely green suburbs which are largely inhabited by whites. Is he threatening to confiscate that as well?
I think that if the initiative gains pace, they won't put the brakes on themselves. We've seen that the African National Congress, you know, it's proven itself to be absolutely rapacious over 30 years. You know, they only take and take and take and take more and take more and take more. It's just a never-ending just, you know, suck the life out of everything around you, devour it, and if you can't be stopped, well, you don't stop yourself, you know. When there's nothing left, that's when you stop. So I would say so, yes, on the basis of the evidence of the past 30 years.
Simon, when you were a young man, you were actually a member of the ANC, and then you were roughed up by the white police force because you were trying to save a black guy from being beaten up. Are you the same Simon then as now? What caused you to be so vociferous against the ANC?
I would say I'm very much the same person. When I was young and naive at university, I thought that it would be a good thing if we could establish racial harmony in South Africa, that it was the natural and right thing to do. And so I was then a card-carrying member of the ANC at university, and there was a protest, and the security police came in heavy-handedly, and a couple of tough policemen were smacking a black guy up. And I was then very strong. Very, very, very tough, strong guy. And so I just walked in and I gave the policemen what they were dishing out. I handed back to them, but by double. And so naturally they bounced on me and threw me in the police van, and I was in big trouble. What has changed to make me so vociferous? I think that if by some sort of magic, you know, an angel had come down or whatever, or if I had some sort of clairvoyance, and I had known then that the African National Congress has no integrity whatsoever. I've had very much close dealings with the African National Congress over years. That there is nil, zero integrity. That it is a party of bad human beings from the beginning to the end, almost without exception. And that they would run our country into the ground. And that according to liberal entities, in other words, entities that are ostensibly sympathetic to the ANC, 35% of all women in South Africa would now be raped. And then, you know, a certain percentage raped twice and some thrice and some six times. And that our economy would be shattered to smithereens by these guys. And that they would rob us blind before our very eyes, shamelessly. Then I wouldn't have been sympathetic at all. I would have been instead of going to university, I would have gone to the police force to become one of those security policemen.
Mm. So anyway, I mean, you're disappointed by the ANC. Just to add in brackets, I mean, you worked after you were an ANC activist in your youth. You had many jobs. You were, a concert organizer, weren't you? And which brought you into... You were the guy who prepared Mandela's funeral or rehearsed his funeral in the stadium, and you were the manager for that. And then you were working a lot. You lived in a youth Zulu hostel for a while because you were doing a lot of simple jobs in your youth. And so you learned to speak fluent Zulu. What I'm saying is you've actually got much more practical experience of Black Africa than many of the liberals in South Africa who are sort of been living in white communities all their lives, you know, so they don't really know about what they're speaking about. Whereas you do. I mean, you're a guy with hands on and you've worked. And I mean, this just the stories I heard of the ANC was it's a country it's 60% youth unemployment, up to 16 hours of power cuts a day because the corruption in the electricity generation industry is so profound. So it must make you completely lose faith in the ANC. I understand that. But I mean, what's going to happen? I mean, are you allowed weapons? I mean, in preparation, you say you're trying to follow the law. Is that correct? You're trying to go within the bounds of it. Yeah. So are you allowed to keep weapons in anticipation of this race war that you say is going to happen?
Yeah. Under the protocols additional to the Geneva Conventions to which you alluded earlier, identifiable ethnic groups may prepare, but there are parameters. We can't, for instance, we may not have explosives or, I don't know, nuclear bombs or submarines or stuff like that, but we may have light arms, which is obviously peanuts compared to a military or a police force. But nevertheless, that's what we do, and we place our trust in the Lord, and we know that he will take good care of us. The ANC has endeavored to kind of ban or outlaw private ownership of light arms, you know, rifles and what have you, on a number of occasions over the past 30 years, but thank God they've been stopped on every occasion. And it's very difficult in a country like South Africa, which is so largely rural, because, you know, lighter arms are necessary for farmers to do all sorts of different things, not just hunting and not just killing vermin. The list is long. And also in a country with such high crime rates, how can you expect a woman alone in a home that may be surrounded by houses where people have been attacked, murdered, whatever, not to be able to defend herself? It's absolutely, it's madness, sheer madness.
Yeah.
I was buying cattle some years ago, about 10 years ago, and I visited a guy, and this was in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, near the town of Estcourt, and standing on his farm, we got to chatting about farm attacks and what have you, and he is surrounded by seven farms. His farm is bordered by seven farms. And he described to me how each of the farms had been attacked. You know, she was shot, he was killed, whatever, different things. He had lost an eye, and his father had been, confined to a wheelchair. So that's 8 out of 8. This is how bad the crime is in South Africa under the African National Congress. It is terrible, and it's getting much worse.
I mean, especially, I'm afraid we've got to start winding up there, but I watched that farm documentary. I think you featured in it, Laura Southern. I'd love to do one, actually. But I mean, if you're a farmer in South Africa, and of course, incredibly efficient industrial producers of food for South Africa and beyond, and exporters of food, and organized people, these people have like the highest death rate in the world. I mean, it's like in a war zone, death rate is 100 per thousand, and the farmers have like 150 per 100,000. So if you live in that environment as you do and have friends who've been killed, and there's a famous hill, isn't there, where they put all the crosses of the South African farmers who've died, I'm amazed there's anyone left, you know. And of course, if they have to give up their farms, it never works out right, because the farms are turned into drinking dens or whatever. It makes you sort of lose faith in humanity. Anyway, Simon Roche, thank you for your perspective. Very interesting stories. And maybe we can talk again. We can find you on Simon Roche, R-O-C-H-E, on Twitter and X. And anywhere else, the Sidelanders website, Sidelanders. Thank you very much, Simon. We'll have you on another time. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT Talk Radio. And we've got another guest with us very shortly.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
Prescription drug pricing points to corporate
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
And Clark Shear athleticism.
It's about your right to be informed. Today, there are real threats to press freedom.
Residential areas.
And your right to know about the world around us. We must protect our right to know, no matter what kind of news is important
That's
to you.
Question.
Before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Sometimes, a car comes along that changes everything. With innovations never thought possible, and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first VWB. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you will never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.
I have a feeling these are the suspects in question. The two occupants look like the people involved in the armed robbery. I'm approaching the vehicle. Request backup. The driver matches the description because of a wide-set nose.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Well, welcome back to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show. We in our final guest shortly coming up. I'll just give some background. Here in Europe, we don't often talk about Christian issues, not even the UK, which is a country that's culturally closest to the United States, and certainly not in Scandinavia, where talking about God is just almost not done, for better or for worse. Americans are, and it's obviously much more comfortable about that. And one thing we haven't talked about so far on this show is the way in which the Trump election or the election campaign of 2024 and in previous years has sometimes been framed in divine ways to mobilize the Christian community and vice versa. I mean, so for some people, Trump has been framed as a kind of satanic figure, whereas others compare him to the coming of the Messiah who will solve all of America's problems and the world's problems. This is a kind of discourse which I'm not familiar with, but so I'll cite it as a news story in the sense that we should discuss things that people are talking about without making a commitment as to whether we believe it or not. And certainly in the Christian community, there's much talk now about whether this total eclipse on the 8th of April, which will tear a swathe through Middle America and give Americans one of the most vivid total solar eclipses they'll have for a long time, and much of the rest of the United States, bar the Midwest, will have a partial solar eclipse. Does this have any meaning? Does it betoken something that's big and important in world history? Well, apparently there's predictions that Oklahoma, which is a state north of Texas, will be a kind of center for gatherings of people, and their recommendations from the local police and so on, that the roads will be packed with people who are going to turn up and this hoping that this divine signal will mean something. And linking it perhaps to the current politics. And of course, there are fears now that there's going to be, might be a nuclear confrontation. I mean, I worry about it, not for secular reasons, not for religious reasons, but just because of the way geopolitics works. And religious people have put that in a sort of biblical framework, either as a positive thing or, I mean, inevitable thing. We talk about the end times, or as a terrible thing that we must do everything to avoid. And that Trump could be the man to make it not happen if we can survive till November, and that somehow this event in the solar eclipse will make it not happen or happen. So I think that I can't quite navigate my way around it, but I think the person who will do this very expertly for us is Troy Anderson, who's a Pulitzer Prize nominated investigative journalist, a number one best-selling Faith Words hashtag author of the Babylon Code and Trumpocalypse. He is the number one best-selling Chosen Books author of The Military Guide to Armageddon and Military Guide to Disarming Deception. He's a former executive of Charisma Magazine and Charisma Media and reporter at the LA Daily News, frequent guest on many radio and television networks, including Newsmax, Daystar, CBN News, and Jewish Voice with Jonathan Bernis. He writes for Reuters, Newsmax, Town Hall, and other media outlets. Welcome to the show, Troy. How are you?
Hi, Papelli. It's great to be on your show.
Trumpocalypse is one of those absolutely intriguing titles that will leaps out at you when you see it in a bookstore or more commonly these days on Amazon or something. What is the elevator pitch for that book? What's it about?
Yeah. So I wrote that book with Paul McGuire. He's used to be a nationally syndicated radio show host back in 2018. And we explored the prophetic significance of the Trump presidency. How did President Trump fit into unfolding end time events? You know, for about a dozen years now, I've been investigating, are we really moving into these end time events the Bible talks about? So Trumpocalypse, which was the number one bestseller, explored what role does Trump play in all this?
Okay. Now, my stupid, simple question, what is the end times?
So the in the Bible, about a third of the Bible is prophetic in nature. It talks about the, you know, essentially the end of the world, what's known as eschatology or prophecies of the future. And so what I've been doing for the last dozen years is investigating, are we really moving into these end time events that the Bible talks about? And, you know, I've interviewed hundreds of faith leaders, experts in every field you can imagine, you know, military officials, intelligence, economics, science, and read hundreds of books, gone through, you know, thousands of pages of government academic documents, just trying to determine what we're seeing today aligning with what the Bible talks about would happen in the end times.
And your short answer is yes.
Short answer, yeah, I believe that we are. In fact, there's in this new book, Revelation 9-11, we list 50 different signs that Jesus and the prophets told us to watch for that would indicate we're moving into this end time period. And if you compare those signs to today's headlines, it's almost like all of them are in some stage of either being fulfilled or, you know, some process in that stage.
So just give a few examples to somebody who's ignorant of the Bible but curious about what you're saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing, you know, the prophet Daniel, he said that knowledge would increase in the end times. And of course, we've seen an exponential increase in knowledge. The apostle John talked about the mark of the beast system in Revelation 13, where you can't buy or sell unless you have this mark. And of course, for the first time in history, we now have the technologies, artificial intelligence, computer chip implants, electronic banking, the surveillance state. You could actually have this mark of the beast system where you can't buy or sell. With the rollout of digital currencies, we could be heading into that kind of system. And of course, you know, since the development of nuclear weapons, we can destroy the world today. And, you know, thank God we haven't, but passages in Revelation that may describe, you know, nuclear war kind of scenario. So there's many things like that, but those are just a few.
That's absolutely fascinating. But aren't the end times preordained? Is there something that we can do about it?
So I did an interview with Billy Graham. He's a world-renowned evangelist back in 2013 for a seven-part series of stories. And he said when God sent the prophet Jonah to Nineveh to warn them of judgment, that the king and the people repented, and then, judgment was averted. And Billy Graham said he believed the same thing could happen again, this time in America or in the world. And so, you know, I believe that God's put the ball in our court. If we return to God, if we do what we're supposed to do, like with Nineveh, we could see essentially the prophetic can kick down the road again.
Right. And sorry, who was Jonah and what was Nineveh in the Bible?
Yeah. So this story is the famous Jonah and the whale story. So Jonah's a prophet. God, you know, calls him to go to Nineveh to warn them of judgment. Of course, he doesn't want to go to Nineveh because Nineveh's, infamous for, you know, all kinds of horrific things they did to people, and especially the Jewish people. And so he didn't want to go there. So he fled on a ship going the other way. And then the famous story is, you know, he's swallowed by this great fish. He's in the belly of this whale or great fish, whatever it is, for 3 days. He gets spit up on the shores of Nineveh, and he appears possibly during an eclipse. or right around that time. And then he, you know, goes into the city and warns them what, you know, God has told them, and they listen and they heed his warning. They repent, they turn from their sins, they put on sackcloth and ashes and the whole nine yards. And God, you know, doesn't relents from his judgment. So that's the story of Jonah and Nineveh and the famous whale.
So the Nineveh, the people of Nineveh see the error of their ways and listen to Jonah. So, yeah. Among Trump supporters, I mean, I know he's quite popular among Christian community. Is Trump seen as a kind of latter-day Jonah?
I guess he could be. Actually, in that book, Trumpocalypse, you know, inspired by that interview with Billy Graham, we actually called for a national day of repentance. There hadn't been one in America since Abraham Lincoln was president. Most presidents from George Washington to Lincoln would call for this, what they call like a national day of prayer, fasting, and humiliation. And essentially, you know, people repent of their sins and turn back to God. George Washington credited this with the birth of America, beating the colonial forces in the Revolutionary War. And Abraham Lincoln credited this day with the North beating the South and ending the scourge of slavery. But we haven't had one of these in, you know, a century and a half. And so we actually called for one in our book, Trumpocalypse. A friend of mine, Kevin Jessup, I met when I was editor of CRISBA. He felt called to lead a national repentance movement. He's a great networker. He networked with a who's who of faith political leaders and persuaded Rabbi Jonathan Cahn, who's a New York Times bestselling author, to be the spokesman. And then this event actually happened. It happened on September 26, 2020 in the National Mall. 250,000 people showed up, 40 million people watched this. And then President Trump had actually issued a proclamation for a day of prayer and return. So he's done a number of things that, you know, that Christians like, essentially, and sort of view as things that are, you know, biblical in nature. And that was one of them.
And what about Biden? Is he seen as the opposite then, a kind of a bad guy all around? Or are you appealing to him as well?
No. Biden is, he's essentially promoting policies that are globalist in nature. You know, the open borders. You know, he even talked about America needs to lead the new world order. You know, and his policies seem to align with, you know, Klaus Schwab's great reset plan, which is sort of like a new terminology for the new world order. And so there's globalist, the elite that want to merge us into this one world system. You know, they're openly talking about it now at the, you know, world government forums in Davos and that kind of thing. And so the Biden administration seems to, you know, go along with these sort of globalist policies.
Do you think that, are you worried about the possibility of nuclear war?
Well, yeah, I think it's just a miracle of God that we haven't had nuclear war. I actually took a class in college on nuclear war, and I studied it and interviewed, you know, like Noam Chomsky, a famous MIT professor. You know, he's come out and said that, you know, if we don't do something to address the possibility of nuclear war, we're going to have a nuclear war. In fact, there's been, you know, many different times throughout history where we've come very, very close to, you know, somebody accidentally pushing the button. And I think it's just God that's held it back. It just seems impossible to me that humanity, with all the mistakes we make, could prevent nuclear war for 80 years now. So I think that's another thing that we need to, you know, pray to God for, to hold back that terrible thing that we have with all these nuclear weapons around the world.
I certainly agree with you on that. Now, you host this radio program, which is what I was referring to in my introduction, where you talking about this solar eclipse, and you're also linking it to some kind of black swan event, which Mike Flynn, which is part of the Trump team, is warning about. And even, I think, Ron Paul, who's a kind of libertarian candidate, black swan is something that's really unusual. What was the black swan event, and what is the significance of this solar eclipse that you're having on April the 8th?
Yeah, so coming up on April 8th, we're going to have this total solar eclipse here in America. It's going to run from Texas up to Maine. And seven years ago, there was another total solar eclipse, ran from the West Coast to the East Coast, ran through all these towns called Salem, which is the ancient name for Jerusalem. And now this new solar eclipse goes through all these cities called Nineveh. We're going back to the story of Nineveh. And then there's going to be like a comet that's going to appear in the sky, known as the Devil's Comet. These two eclipses form a gigantic X in the middle of America, centered on the New Madrid fault line, where there was a gigantic earthquake in the early 1800s. This area is known as Little Egypt, you know, of course, reminiscent of the plagues of Egypt, story of Moses and the, you know, bringing the Israelites from slavery. And then if you overlay the 2017 eclipse with the 2024 eclipse and the annular eclipse we had last year, It forms the Hebrew letters Aleph and Tav, or Alpha and Omega, beginning and the end, the name of Jesus, the last chapter of Revelation. So it seems like there's all these sort of prophetic meanings embedded in this eclipse. And then last weekend, Ron Paul and Lieutenant General Michael Flynn were being interviewed, and they talked about, could there be a black swan event during this eclipse or sometime between now and the presidential election, inferring that the deep state could stage some kind of event to try to prevent the election from going forward. Of course, it's just speculation. We have no idea what's going to happen, but there are government agencies aligned in the totality of this eclipse that are warning people to stock up on and that kind of thing.
Troy, get ready for some, you're certainly having me scurrying for my atlas now to see whether all these places in called Nineveh in the United States. It's a fascinating thing to think about, but we'll hope the planet survives after April the 8th, but certainly something to think about. Troy, thank you very much for being on the TNT show. Really interesting new perspectives. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's afternoon show for TNT Radio.